Happy Monday and welcome back to the WOMED. I'm really pumped about this episode. I know I say that a lot, but when you love what you do, it's easy. But for real, health policy is something we don't always think about or realize its importance until we're burnt out and it's too late. This week, I get to speak with former PBS health correspondent, Susan Dentzer. Susan has worked on a range of healthcare policies and is passionate about explaining policy and making it relatable, as well as bringing more clinicians to Washington to help make these decisions. I hope you're ready. This one really lit a fire in me. Okay, guys, going out on a limb here with this, but there's nothing more nursey energy than this. Make sure y'all are registered to vote. Double check your polling locations. Read up on not just the presidential candidates, but Senate and local government officials running as well. Make a plan to vote. Whether that is requesting your mail-in ballot, make sure you request it now and that you drop it off at a ballot box or read up on correctly filling it out and mailing it in so it actually does count and doesn't get discarded. Vote early if you can. The polling locations are going to be very busy on election day. Day shifters might have a more difficult time getting to the polls. This is where voting early is very helpful. Make a plan and vote, y'all. All right, good morning, Susan. Welcome to the WOMED. Thank you so much for making the time to speak with me today.
It's great to be with you, Danielle. Thanks so much.
For those of you who don't know, Susan Dentzer is, she was a health correspondent for PBS for a decade, correct?
That's right.
What all led you to that field? I mean, my old co-host, that's like her ultimate goal is to be like a health correspondent. And she's a nurse practitioner, CVICU. Her brain is amazing. So,
oh, that's great. Well, I was a longtime print journalist.
Oh.
I came up through the ranks at some publications that used to be pretty big deals back in the day. They kind of faded from glory. Newsweek magazine.
I remember Newsweek.
Yeah, I was the writer of business news for many years at Newsweek. I was, among other things, the Wall Street correspondent.
Wow.
And I actually was covering economic policy. Mm-hmm. And one day my editor threw me a story that really was about for-profit hospital companies. And I started reporting this story. It was not something I had done previously. And I stumbled into the fact that there were some major health policy changes afoot that were going to potentially affect the fortunes of these companies. And one thing led to another. And I said, you know, there's this really interesting area of healthcare that is a kind of a business.
Yeah.
The first time I had ever thought of healthcare as having a business aspect to it, but obviously it did. It had for many years. And as you know, that was long ago. So healthcare at the time, I want to say, was probably about 7% of the gross domestic product. It was pretty small. And of course, today it's almost 18% of a much, much larger economy. So the business aspect of healthcare has, if anything, only boomed massively since then. But as that was starting to happen back in the 80s, I said, you know, this is really interesting stuff. There's almost nobody reporting or writing about it, which is hard to believe now, but it was true then.
Yeah.
And I said, I think I'm just going to start learning as much as I can about this. So I did. I spent several years still at Newsweek writing more and more about healthcare and health policy. I went up to Harvard on a journalism fellowship and spent that year pretty much devoted to learning more about healthcare and health policy. Then I moved down to Washington and became the chief economics correspondent at U.S. News and World Report with the deal that I could devote a lot of my time to writing about health care and health policy. And I covered many of the major, major health policy fights, really battles of that era. And then when I went to the PBS NewsHour in 1998, it was to create the first health policy unit that the NewsHour had ever had, devoted specifically to health policy. And then when I got there, it turned out that that was not just going to be a job covering health policy. It was going to be essentially everything that had to do with health and healthcare that came across our desks. So I ended up really as the fully functioning on-air health correspondent for the NewsHour for 10 years. I was then wooed away to become the editor-in-chief of the leading health policy journal of the era, Health Affairs. And so I did that for 5 years and got even deeper into policy as a consequence of that.
Oh, wow. I mean, my head's spinning. Like, so you didn't have necessarily like a background in medicine. So like, how much does like a background in healthcare necessarily help you in like speaking to like policy? Because policy is more business. I'm a nurse, you know, coming from the bedside, like I only know the medical world. Like that's what I'm more fluent in. Like,
yeah. Well, it's an interesting, I would say it's a problem in health policy generally, because these fields tend to get really siloed. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of friends who are clinicians of one sort or another. They're physicians, they're nurses, et cetera. Some of them get really interested in health policy and know a lot about it. Mm-hmm. Others of it never, ever kind of come to grips with it until they wake up one day late in their careers and they go, oh my God, healthcare is a mess, or
yes,
things are happening that I don't understand, or things are going off the rails or whatever. And then they sort of kind of stumble into the fact that there are all of these forces much bigger than they are shaping what goes on in the healthcare system. And then they wake up and realize, oh yeah, there's policy here. There are laws that get passed that affect healthcare. Let's take, for example, the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. There are people making decisions in Washington, either members of Congress, their staffs, the agency people. Look at what's going on now in the pandemic. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of what is, I guess we would say, going wrong in the pandemic is a consequence of policy decisions being made or not being made.
Yeah.
That's really what I got quite interested in. How do all of these forces come together to create the guardrails around what it is that the healthcare system does for good and for ill? Mm-hmm. And what is the effect of all of that on all of us as citizens, ultimately? Mm-hmm. As I was saying, I think there's definitely, from my perspective, I'm always shocked that people in healthcare don't think more about health policy than many of them do. I mm-hmm. teach a lot in medical school curricula as well as other places. And I'm just always shocked that there isn't more health policy in medical school curricula, because policy is going to have as much impact on people's lives in the healthcare profession as, you know, as what they learned about anatomy.
You know, it's very true.
Yeah. And just at least getting introduced, you can never learn all of this in you know, one health policy course. I mean, the knowledge mm-hmm. I have is the knowledge I've picked up over several decades of doing this.
Yeah.
But you can at least get exposed to the basic concepts mm-hmm. and I'm alert to it. It's like going to a museum after you've taken one art history course. You're going to, even on the basis of one art history course, you're going to start looking at paintings a different way. Same thing with health policy, to at least be introduced to the basics and understand that there are these forces that are going to shape things. Mm-hmm. I think is really, really important.
No, I couldn't agree more. I mean, my nursing school wasn't very strong in our, I shouldn't say they didn't produce like strong nursing leaders per se. It just, you know, that course was put at the very end of our senior year and, you know, we're all checked out. We're worried about, you know, completing our senior thesis and our final nursing rotations in like our practicums, and like that leadership course was like the furthest thing from the majority of our minds. And I feel like in that is where they stuck in some policy stuff. And I think part of what leads to like nursing burnout and like the frustration with how we're feeling in our current jobs is that we don't really have a full understanding or even like a small understanding of what actually goes into healthcare policy.
I think that's right. And I know a lot of nurses in particular whose first sort of entry point into health policy is around what is a very important issue in nursing, which is scope of practice, mm-hmm. right? And particularly the degree to which nurses and advanced nurse practitioners in particular have or have not been allowed to practice independently across the country, mm-hmm. whether they have to practice under quote unquote physician supervision, how much prescribing they can do, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And after you've been through nursing school and then you've gotten either your doctor of nursing practice or whatever, and then you bump up against the fact that depending on what state you're in, your capabilities of doing things are either more broad or more limited. Mm-hmm. Then you go, what's this about? Well, that's scope of practice. And yeah. In the U.S., of course, we've delegated a lot of the so-called police powers to states. So mm-hmm. states generally have regulated many aspects and almost all aspects of the health professions around and licensure and so forth. And of course, for years, many state legislatures were dominated by physicians. Mm-hmm. So physicians viewed advanced nurse practitioners often as a threat. Not all do, of course. Right. The enlightened ones don't, but there are many unenlightened who do. And mm-hmm. so they managed to basically throttle back nurses and advanced nurse practitioners in particular in many jurisdictions. And in fact, one of the stories I covered years ago when I was at US News was at one point there was a lot of concern about a so-called nursing shortage, mm-hmm. Which you still hear periodically talked about. And what it really comes down to is there's not a shortage of nurses. There's sometimes lack of availability of enough nurses in particular markets who want to work in hospitals. Mm. You know, there are plenty of nurses there. They're just working for insurance companies as case managers or something else because mm-hmm. not everybody wants to work the hours that you need to work if you're in the hospital or the shifts you need to work in the hospital. So yeah. Periodically around the country, depending on what people are willing to pay, it's harder or easier to hire nurses. And that really was the issue back then, even as it is in some instances today. Anyway, mm-hmm. because of this, the American Medical Association of the time decided that what really needed to happen is that we needed to create a new class of registered care technicians, mm-hmm. RCTs,
okay,
who would be male by and large.
Okay.
And when they described the kinds of things that they wanted these RCTs to do, it sounded a whole lot like nurses.
And okay.
So it looked like what the AMA was trying to do was create a job that was just like nursing, that wasn't called nursing, and that was for men. Because it was perceived at the time that men were not going to want to become nurses. So the gotcha. AMA got to work trying to create this new position. And of course, as you can imagine,
Of destigmatizing, like, right. that nursing is just for women.
Right. So the nursing associations and groups went, as you would predict, ballistic.
Yep. Sounds about right.
And said, what the hell are you doing? And there was mm-hmm. a huge fight with the AMA over this, and the AMA eventually had to back down, mm-hmm. and the whole notion of registered care technicians died on the vine. Well, that, you know, welcome to health policy, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes health policy, you know, originates outside, say, the Congress or the government. It did in that case. It was basically a movement started by the AMA. It ran smack up into the opposition from the nursing unions. The nurses were able to call in their allies, lawmakers and others, who basically started, you know, asking questions about this and looking into it. The AMA, if it had gone ahead with this, would have had to create, you know, schools for registered care technicians. There would have to be curriculums. They would have to be licensed in states. So lots of things were going to have to happen downstream in the policy world to support this movement of registered care technicians. In the end, none of that happened because the AMA backed down. So that's, again, I think in a nutshell, illustrates why it's a good idea to think about health policy.
Yeah, my mind's blown. I mean, thinking about just if that had gone through, and like the amount of discord in the hospitals then between, you know, registered care technicians and nurses, and like, would they have even be seen as equal in the hospital setting? It sounds like the male-dominated physician world wanted to bring in more men, which wow.
That's clear. It's clearly what in part was behind it. And yes, instead of what has come to pass, right, which is that men have gone into nursing.
And they're great nurses. We do actually have a fair amount of male nurses that listen to the podcast. So shout out to you guys, because thank you.
Yeah. So men have gone into nursing. Some of my good friends who are clinicians are nurses who are men. Mm-hmm. You know, the stigma piece doesn't matter to them, or if it matters, right, it's a joke now, you know. They got used long ago. They got used to getting teased by their friends.
Right? Yeah.
In the field, and they know it's nonsense. And so they've moved on. And that, yes, let us try to contemplate what would have happened if this movement to create these RCTs had succeeded. And you had really cemented in these gender roles.
Yeah.
What a difference it would have made.
Oh my gosh. Thank God that didn't happen.
Yep. Well, I like to think I was only one person writing about it. Although I must say it was a story that pretty much had not made it into the general news media before I wrote about it. And I like to think
I had a small role.
It was a small role in bringing it to light and causing people to wake up and see what was happening, and decide in the end, the majority clearly decided it was a bad idea.
Well, that's where the written word is just so powerful. And I, like, knowing this now, I'm even more grateful to you and the work that you have done in shedding light on these topics, because especially as nurses, and I'm speaking into, you know, those in like the hospital fields and or in like nursing homes, you know, we're tired. Like, we're working all day, all night, or we're emotionally depleted. And the last thing we want to do when we come home is thinking about the next way we're going to be, like, excuse me for saying this, but like shit on at work, you know?
Right. Which is a reason. And this is the good side of being in a leadership course, because it's good to be awakened early on.
Yes.
To the reality that, and it isn't for everybody. Some people are not going to want to do these roles because they're not easy, but rising up to a leadership level, either within an organization or a healthcare organization or a nursing organization, or even moving into a policymaking role in the government with a clinical background is, first of all, it's a really interesting career path for people.
Yeah.
And it's important. It's important to have those capabilities represented in policymaking. I was saying earlier, I thought it was regrettable that a lot of clinicians don't know about policy, but it's also mm-hmm. true that when policy isn't informed by clinical knowledge, that can also be problematic.
Right.
And so having people who have been clinicians who are also in policymaking roles, I think is important. And some of the best people I've met over the years who are in positions of authority in the government around health policy, mm-hmm. many of them maintain a clinical practice just because they want to stay connected, first yeah. of all, to that line of work. And they want their, even their policy perspective grounded by the realities of day-to-day life in the clinic.
I'm so happy to hear that. And it's one thing that I've spent a lot of time like encouraging some other guests and stuff that I've interviewed on here who are, I feel like they're just powerhouses in the medical field, and they have a great voice. They're not scared to share it. And I'm like, y'all need to like run for Congress, be senators, be like, figure out a way, because we need more voices more clinical voices represented in the government.
Absolutely. And in policy positions,
right,
of all sorts. One of the other jobs I had in life, I was the senior policy advisor to a big foundation, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which is the largest philanthropy in the U.S. that is focused solely on health and healthcare issues in the U.S. And that foundation for years has run a fellowship. It's called the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Health Policy Fellows Program.
Okay.
And six to eight people a year are selected to come to Washington, go through this fellowship. It has several months of orientation where it's just a crash course on health policy issues and lots of meeting and greeting with people in aspects of health policy in Washington. And then the people go out and get a position, either working on a congressional staff or in the office of a member of Congress or a job at one of the federal agencies, and spend the better part of a year in that role doing real health policy work, real on-the-ground health policy work.
Wow.
And that fellowship, which is aimed at mid-career people, mm-hmm. Obviously draws people who have already been bitten a bit by the policy bug. Mm-hmm. Some people come and then go back to their institution. A lot of people come from the academic field. They'll go back to their institution and they'll set up a center for health policy at their university, or they'll be involved in some sort of health policy educational effort. But a lot of people get bitten by the bug permanently and never go back. And they mm-hmm. stay in Washington. They go to work on on congressional staff, or they somehow or other find their way into a permanent policy role, because life can be really interesting in those.
Yeah. Roles. Yeah. I'm not going to lie. I'm getting a little like, oh, well, that sounds exciting.
Yep, exactly. In fact, a friend of mine, Deb Troutman, is a case in point. She's was a nurse, still mm-hmm. is, had this fellowship, got really interested in policy, worked on the staff of Nancy Pelosi.
Oh, wow.
Is very close to Speaker Pelosi to this very day, and mm-hmm. to other people on Pelosi's staff. And is now the head of the American Association of Colleges of Nursing.
Wow.
And in between her fellowship and her current job, she went back to Johns Hopkins, where she had been, and created the Center for Health Policy at Johns Hopkins. So she's kind of a case in point. And there are other nurses who've gone through the program who've also gone on to do comparable things and really, really, I think, made a difference.
I always get so excited to go to the farmers markets and get fresh vegetables and fruits. But with the seasons changing, so will the available produce. I love to eat as clean as I can while still incorporating foods that taste really good. So whether I'm having a relaxing day or I'm on the go, I love having my freezer stocked with Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest works directly with farmers to harvest and freeze fruits and veggies at the peak of ripeness to lock in nutrients and taste. They never use preservatives, added sugar, or artificial ingredients, so you can name every single ingredient in your packaging. That makes me feel so much better about what's going in my body. With Daily Harvest, there's an option for any time of day. Delicious blend-and-go smoothies for breakfast, crisp flatbreads for lunch, and hearty grain bowls or savory soups for dinner. They even have plant-based ice cream, for which my stomach says thank you. Daily Harvest is also committed to minimizing their environmental impact. They are in the process of transitioning to 100% recyclable, plant-based, and renewable fiber packaging. So whether you're doing a home workout, going on a bike ride, or a hike, Daily Harvest is the easiest way to eat undeniably delicious, clean food. Go to dailyharvest.com and enter code WOMED for $25 off your first box. That's promo code WOMED for $25 off your first box at dailyharvest.com. That's dailyharvest.com.
Wow. I'm processing this knowledge and I'm like, who else needs to know about this? I'm so excited we're having this conversation because I hope that like anyone that's out there, you know, listening right now is thinking that like this is sparking a little bit of fire in them to, you know, help lead and like figure out these changes that need to be made in health policy. And I'm not gonna lie, I'm excited. I'm gonna look up this fellowship when we when we finish this interview.
Yes. Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Health Policy Fellows.
Yeah. Okay.
And even, you know, independent of getting a great fellowship like that, there are just so many things that can be done and need to be done at the local level. You know,
right.
Making your, if you're in a particular state, making your lawmakers aware of issues and challenges in healthcare that they have a role in, should have a role in addressing or creating. Mm-hmm. I know a lot in a lot of places around the country, the clinical field has been really instrumental in bringing to the minds of legislators why certain things should happen in healthcare that they aren't getting done. A classic is, as we know, under the Affordable Care Act, the decision was made to write into the law an expansion of the Medicaid program, because the Medicaid program, which was aimed at poor people, really only covered about half of people in the country who were technically poor. And because of the way the law was written, the Medicaid program is a partnership between states and the federal government. And certain basic requirements were set at the federal level, and then states could add to the Medicaid program if they chose to do that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of states had moved to cover a group of people who were known as, the cleanest way to describe it is, adults without dependent children. So these are grown adults who don't have kids that are classified as dependents for tax purposes, right? So, think of a 45-year-old man without dependent children, or a 45-year-old woman, or a 50-year-old woman without dependent children. Mm-hmm. Well, in many states, if you were above a certain income threshold and you were in that category, you could not qualify for Medicaid, and the income eligibility levels were pretty low. If you had income more than $6,000 a year in many states, and you were in this category, an adult without dependent children, you could not qualify for Medicaid.
Wow.
$6,000 a year, like half the poverty level, right?
Yeah.
So what Congress did when the ACA was enacted, it said, you know what, we're going to basically cover people up to, this is a technical term, 138% of the federal poverty level. So basically almost 1.4 times what we consider the poverty level. So it's people just above what we classify as poverty, who frankly are still pretty low income, right?
Right.
It's not a lot of money.
Yeah.
And the deal was that the federal government was going to pay 100% of the cost of this for a few years. And then the formula was going to drop a bit so that eventually the federal government was paying 90% of the money to cover this pool of people, and states had to put up 10%.
Okay.
So by any stretch of imagination, it was a good deal for states because the federal government was going to pay most of the money to cover basically a pool of 7 or 8 million poor people who didn't have health care coverage.
Right.
Well, then people who will know this story will know that the Affordable Care Act was challenged in court. It went all the way to the Supreme Court. And in 2012, the Supreme Court ruled that the law was indeed constitutional, except for the Medicaid expansion piece, because the federal government couldn't force states to expand their Medicaid program if they didn't want to. So at that point, the Medicaid expansion became optional. States didn't have to do it. They could take all this federal money, give people more health insurance, or they could not do it. And as a consequence, to this day, there are 14 states that still have elected not to expand their Medicaid programs, which means that this pool of people, adults without dependent children, just above the poverty level, and in some instances below the poverty level, cannot qualify for Medicaid. And if you think about who is affected by this, sometimes it's people who have other issues. Mental illness is very common in this
population. Very, very common.
It's people who have frequently struggled through their lives. That's part of the reason why they don't necessarily have dependents. And they are in this pool of states that have not expanded Medicaid, one of the biggest being Texas, which now has the most uninsured people in the country of any state in the union, and the highest uninsured rate. Tennessee is another one. North Carolina is another one, where there have been pitched battles over many, many years over expanding Medicaid. The hospitals all want to see this population insured, because otherwise, they're still required to treat people if they show up. We have this federal law in TALA that requires people to be treated if they show up for on an emergency basis. They've got to be treated and stabilized. So hospitals still have to do that. They either have to write this off as bad debt or charity care. So they want to see Medicaid expanded. Almost all economic analyses that have been done show that if you do expand Medicaid in your state, you're bringing in federal dollars. Those go to hospitals. It creates jobs because jobs are created. People pay more taxes, and there's overall economic benefit. There's not one analysis that has shown anything other than expanding Medicaid is of economic benefit to your state. And despite all of that, we still have these 14 states that have not expanded Medicaid. And but for some of the advocacy that has gone on by clinicians, this issue would remain buried in many states. I do a lot of work, obviously, in North Carolina. And the clinical community has kept this issue alive. The governor, Roy Cooper, who's a Democrat, has been trying to get Medicaid expanded. The legislature is in Republican hands, so that it hasn't gone through, but hope springs eternal. And it is, as I say, it's the hospital association, the clinical community, that are basically saying, this is foolish for the state to be doing this economically. It's foolish, but also it's wrong. It's immoral. How can you just cut off a path to coverage for people who have no other way of getting it? So it's just another illustration of the fact that these issues really matter, and clinical voices need to be at the table calling our public representatives out on their lack of action in these arenas.
Yes.
thank you for being on this podcast and being able to speak into so many of these issues. I had written down a question, and I know I sent these to you, and I was like, and I know, and I didn't want to offend you with the question because healthcare policy before, you know, this conversation really made my head spin, and it still does like a little bit, but like, thankful for this conversation. You're helping me to understand this. But I wrote down like, how do you make healthcare policy more interesting and get people more excited about like making these changes?
I think you have to connect it to people's lives, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you have to tell why these things matter in the lives of people. And that's, you know, what I loved about my job at the NewsHour is that I could do that. I could tell stories about policy came down to the lives of people. If the debate was over whether Medicare should cover prescription drugs that are taken, you know, outside of the hospital setting, which, you know, it's hard for, so wrap your brain around this one. Until 2003, the Medicare program, right, which basically is for people 65 and older, as well as disabled populations can qualify for Medicare under certain circumstances. So there are 10 million or so disabled people on Medicare as well. Mm-hmm. So this huge program covers the elderly, did not pay for prescription drugs taken on an outpatient basis until 2003.
And you
go, okay, so
like insulin.
Yeah. Just nothing. Wow. Nothing was paid for, right?
Wow.
Until 2003. Now, a law had been passed in 1987, the Medicare Catastrophic Coverage Act, that had a drug benefit in it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very contentious law, and for various reasons, it was repealed before this drug benefit went into effect. So from that point, basically from 1989 until 2003, there was no drug benefit.
And there was
a longstanding, you know, set of proposals. We've got to get a drug benefit.
Mm-hmm.
In the 2000 election, that it was a huge issue.
Mm-hmm.
And Al Gore was running for the presidency against George W. Bush, whether there was going to be a drug benefit was a huge, huge issue.
Yeah.
And as we know, George W. Bush won. He did get through, and Congress did get through a drug benefit. It was structured differently than many Democrats wanted, but nonetheless, it came about. And so for the years since then, we've had the so-called Part D drug benefit in Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
But it took forever to get it enacted.
Yeah.
And you look back on that and you go, so what was anybody thinking, right? That we could have this big coverage program without a mechanism to pay for prescription drugs. So it just tells you these issues are always there. They're going to change. It takes a long time to effectuate meaningful changes at the federal policy level in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes the forces coming together to bring these things about. But I think it's just a really powerful illustration that these things matter in the lives of people. And as I was saying, being at the NewsHour and being able to go and show people who were really struggling because they even then couldn't afford to pay for their prescription drugs. I remember going in 2000 out to Michigan, and Senator Debbie Stabenow was campaigning for office, and that was one of her big platforms, is we've got to get a Medicare drug benefit. And then I went, you go to senior centers and would meet these seniors who were just really, really struggling. Because if they went into the hospital, their needs got taken care of. If they tried to stay at home in their communities and just afford the drugs that they had to take, they were really, really really struggling financially. So yeah. being able to tell those stories and why this policy mattered, that's how you make health policy interesting to people.
Yeah. That's how you get people hooked. So what are you doing right now? You're starting a new, are you doing a podcast too, or you're working with Optum Healthcare?
Yes, I'm working with Optum. They asked me to be the voice of a podcast that they're starting. It's called Until It's Fixed. And it speaks
like
to some of the issues we've been talking about. The it yeah. here is healthcare. You know, until healthcare is fixed, mm-hmm. there's a lot of work to do. I love that title. It's kind of aspirational because I sort mm-hmm. of think I've concluded healthcare will never really be fixed.
It's, you know, right.
It's an issue that will constantly need tending. Mm-hmm. But I sympathize with the notion that there are many things that we can do and should be doing in healthcare. Mm-hmm. And the capabilities of an organization like Optum at this point in time are really, really important to bring to bear on some of the really nettlesome problems we have in healthcare, especially mm-hmm. in the United States. Mm-hmm. So as we all know, we spend more, far and away more, on a per person basis than any other country on our healthcare system. The next biggest spender usually in any given year is Switzerland, and we spend about 50% more per person than even they do in Switzerland on their healthcare system. And if you've been wow. to Switzerland and seen their hospitals, you think, wow, they couldn't possibly get much better than this. Well, mm-hmm. it does get more expensive than that. It gets much more expensive here in the United States without comparable health outcomes. You know, we mm-hmm. don't have any of the leading health indicators. We are so far behind mm-hmm. our peer countries, partly because we're such a diverse and heterogeneous country, but mm-hmm. also because we have this very, very expensive healthcare system. The prices that we charge in our healthcare system are far and away the highest in the world on average.
Wow.
So we've got all these issues going on. And then one of the other issues, which is almost unique to the United States, is that because we have such a complicated set of insurance schemes, we've got Medicare, we've got Medicaid, we've got commercial insurance, we've got employers, mm-hmm. who are so-called self-insured. They're actually paying their employees' healthcare out of the corporate pocket. We've got state and local forms of coverage for state and local workers. You know, we've got a very fragmented system of health coverage for people. Mm-hmm. And because of that, we have a lot of complexity that's built in at the administrative level. And basically what that means is we hire a ton of people to basically figure out, what does this insurance program cover? Mm-hmm. How is that different from what that insurance program covers? If I'm sitting at a hospital and a doctor does something to a patient and submits a claim, how do I get the right code written on that claim so that the insurance company will pay it? Mm-hmm. How do I document that what the doctor says was done actually was done, right?
Right.
All of that has historically had to be done manually. Mm-hmm. So, and then that goes to the insurance company, who has an equally large phalanx of people saying, did the right diagnostic code get written in here? Was this procedure subject to prior authorization that did or did not happen? Should we pay this claim or not? If we decide no, then we send it back to the hospital or doctor's office. Somebody back there tears their hair out, goes, okay, now what do we do? Did we code this wrong? Did the insurance company screw up? Whatever. So that whole administrative piece of our system is so much bigger than anybody else's. Any other
has
anything remotely like this, of this mm-hmm. complexity. And that costs a lot of money. And some of the estimates are that we spend as much on that activity every year in the U.S. as we spend on treating all of heart disease in the country. And heart disease is the biggest killer of Americans, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you go, well, that seems really stupid.
Yeah.
What could we do to make that easier? So mm-hmm. a company like Omptum can step in with a lot of sophisticated people who understand, first of all, understand this mess.
Yeah.
Understand what are some of the causes of this mess, whether it's this whole problem around coding, whether it's any form of administrative complexity that can be addressed because you are able to build computer systems and computer programs that, first of all, keep a lot of this work from being manual and mm-hmm. kind of systematize it, but also deal with some of these issues around the back and forth and all of that, and do a better job of just getting things, if things are going to be pre-authorized, then get that done well. Mm-hmm. Take that administrative complexity and simplify it. So
yeah,
these are like the really unglamorous parts of healthcare. You're never going to see a Netflix series about, you know, coding and billing, you know, the dramatic story of the coders who work behind the scenes, right?
Yeah.
It never happened, but it's important stuff. And if it translates into the fact that your overall healthcare system is unaffordable to people, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Unaffordable and complex beyond all imagination, then it needs to be fixed. And that's partly why we're doing this podcast, is to surface these really, really important issues that a company like Optum, and Optum's not alone, there are mm-hmm. plenty of other organizations in this field, but to surface that these things are happening, that there are companies that are addressing them and hopefully getting them fixed.
In your opinion, which country has healthcare and like health insurance and everything like figured out so that like they aren't creating like a huge deficit, they're still getting paid, they're, you know, because I don't know much about like the whole, like the, what healthcare is like in different countries either. So I'm wondering if you have an opinion on that.
Well, I would say there is no country that has figured and if you had, if we were sitting here today and we had the health minister, you know, usually in most countries it's called the Ministry of Health. We call ours mm-hmm. the Department of Health and Human Services. Mm-hmm. So if you had our head of Health and Human Services and the health ministers of all the top 20 richest countries in the world mm-hmm. here today, and you said, raise your hand, the person here who believes your health system has got it all figured out, not one hand would go up.
Yeah.
Because everybody understands, every system is dealing with something.
Right.
And usually it's more than one something. It's some things, right? That mm-hmm. because this is enormously complicated business. Mm-hmm. You're in almost every country, you're paying the bills for healthcare partly through taxes mm-hmm. at the public setting, but also there's a lot of private spending everywhere, even places where people think they know how the system works. Like people will tell me, you know, Canada has a single payer system. Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't. It doesn't. It has a program called Medicare. Mm-hmm. That is true. It is financed in part at the federal level in Canada, but also by the provinces. But there also is private insurance available mm-hmm. in Canada as well. And the provinces also are the entities that create the prescription drug program in Canada. So could you call that a single payer system? Not literally, right?
Yeah.
It's a hybrid system. Now, is it more publicly financed than our system is in terms of the proportions? Yes. Mm-hmm. But if you think about our insurance system, so we have a very large program, Medicaid, with more than 70 million enrollees. We've got a very large program, Medicare. Mm-hmm. We've got a lot of state and local spending. We have essentially close to half of our healthcare spending is run through public insurance programs of some sort or another. So you could look at what we're doing. You could say, well, the Americans are basically running four or five Canadas in terms of the magnitude of the, right? Mm-hmm. And nobody makes the mistake of calling us a single payer system because we're not. But by the same token, Canada's not really single payer either. Mm-hmm. So, because what it is doing is very different from, say, the system in the countries who make up the United Kingdom. So anyway, I'm getting a little bit off point, but to your question, no country feels like they've got it figured out.
Yeah.
There are countries that we can learn from at what they do better than we do. And one big takeaway, I think, for our system is that almost every country puts more money proportionally into primary care than we do. We spend more of our dollars on specialty care and less on primary care. Mm-hmm. We pay our primary care physicians and clinicians less, much less than we pay specialists.
Yeah.
And the gap between what primary care is paid and specialty care is paid in most other countries is much narrower than here. And in fact, primary care docs are usually paid much better in other countries than they tend to be paid here on a relative basis. So that's a real takeaway that we can learn, because we have lots of research that shows if you spend more money on primary care, you will get better health outcomes for people.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to prevent it before you have to treat it.
Yeah. So, but we don't do that. So that's a clear takeaway that we could take away from more than one country.
Yeah.
That is doing things better than we are.
Wow.
On the other hand, you know, other countries have also copied us.
Yeah.
To some degree. Mm-hmm. They've, if you take even England, for example, which has the National Health Service, that's a tax-funded system. It's not monolithic. You know, the what's called a primary care doctor there, which is called general practitioners, GPs.
Okay.
They don't work for the government. They're private physicians. Because they treat patients in the context of the National Health Service, the rules of the National Health Service do apply to them, but the docs are independent and private, and they have their issues with the health service, like everybody would imagine they would.
Yeah.
But then when you go to a hospital, which are run by trusts, they're foundation trusts, those are government hospitals, and the specialists work for the hospitals, and they are National Health Service employees. The tax funding of the National Health Service, you know, as I say, all countries think their health system is too expensive, even if it's much less expensive than ours is. They worry about it. They worry about the tax burden on citizens, and they worry about the cost of the system. And so what has been done in England is people said, you know, we can't finance this whole system through the tax code. And maybe people want more in healthcare than they're willing to pay in taxes. So how do we deal with that? We have to create some kind of a small private insurance system so that people can buy private insurance. And if they want to, they can get out from under the National Health Service and go through the private system.
Interesting.
So they looked at us and they said, huh. Maybe those Americans are on to something in having some private health insurance, which can be a kind of relief valve in the system, right? Mm-hmm. So you can be in England, you can go through the National Health Service and see a specialist, but the very same specialist can also go down the street to a private office and see you if you have private health insurance, and you possibly could, because you have private health insurance, jump the queue, right?
Wow.
Of waiting in line to see the specialist through the public system. Mm-hmm. Now, if you go to England, you will find people who think that's really great. that we did that. And yeah. you will find people who say that is anathema that we did that. Right? just like here.
Yeah.
But yeah. it just tells you, you know, countries are always looking around, saying, who's dealing with these problems in a mm-hmm. different way than we are? And is there anything we can learn from them?
Yeah.
We need to learn a fair amount from other countries, and they have obviously learned from us for better, for worse.
Right. So I always like to kind of, you know, end with like what are you most proud of in your career?
I am most proud of having taken these pretty complex topics mm-hmm. and made them understandable and accessible to people.
Yeah.
As much as I have been able to do, I can't say that I've always succeeded, because sometimes they're very complicated, but to give people a sense that these issues are important, that they matter, that they affect people's lives, mm-hmm. That we all have an obligation to understand them, at least some, mm-hmm. and not be misled by people who want to manipulate our understanding or our opinions, mm-hmm. but really come to grips with reality, how these issues are affecting the lives of other people, and essentially using my skills as a communicator and explainer to open these doors for people.
Yeah. I think you can be very proud of that. I mean, you've helped me understand more in the hour that we've been talking than I managed to figure out in like 12 years as a bedside nurse. So,
oh, well, hardly that. Believe me, if the tables were turned, you could teach me a ton about nursing. I'm quite confident of that.
Well, Susan, one more time, where will your podcast and stuff be available?
Everywhere podcasts are generally available.
Awesome.
Apple Podcasts, obviously, as well as the other podcast services, you'll be able to find us. It's until it's fixed, and it makes its debut in October.
That's so exciting. When does it come out in October?
I believe our release date is the 6th.
That's my birthday.
Oh, well, happy birthday. You know you'd get a new podcast for your birthday, Danielle.
I'm flattered. That's really a beautiful gift. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. From the bottom of our hearts.
Well, I'm so grateful to you, Susan, for, you know, making the time and your ability to explain these complicated policies. I mean, like, I'm definitely excited to kind of jump in a little bit more on policy and learning. And, you know, I have this platform, and I want to, you know, be able to empower and drop knowledge and stuff on these subjects as well. So thank you.
Happy to help any of your listeners. And just one tip, a good all-around source of information about health policy is everything published by the Kaiser Family Foundation
at okay.
KFF, as in KaiserFamilyFoundation.org. Very readable, very explainable background materials on every issue that matters in policy. And they've got a number of news services through their news organization, Kaiser Health News, puts out a daily roundup of key issues in health policy as they're covered by news media organizations across the country. You can sign up for that. Just a wealth of information and it's really the go-to place for anybody starting out to learn about what's going on in health policy.
Awesome. I'm going to include that in the show notes for everybody.
Great.
All right, Susan, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thanks, and you too, Danielle, and happy birthday.
Thank you.
Another massive thank you to Susan Dentzer. Y'all, I'm jazzed and empowered. Make sure to check out her podcast, Until It's Fixed, which drops October 6th, and the Kaiser Family Foundation for more information on healthcare policy and how we can help make these changes in healthcare for each other. Thank you all for tuning in. Don't forget to send in your nursey energy moments to me at the WOMED. Thank you. I love you. Until next week, WOMED out.